Well, good evening, everybody, and thank you for coming. I'm Brian Fettig. I'd like to begin by thanking the board members for inviting me to be here tonight, particularly the guy that can't be here tonight, Toby Reynolds. Too bad he can't see this. I met Toby 2 years ago on the historic Milwaukee tour of the Water Tower neighborhood. His house happened to be on the tour. So with that intro, I've been asked to talk not so much about the physical things in the neighborhood that are being taken care of by all the regulations that accompany being a landmark neighborhood, but to talk about the more intangible part of it, the families, the neighbors, and the story that actually made this a neighborhood, not just a collection of houses. This is the part that really isn't written down for too many people. Can everybody see? Am I loud enough?
Yep.
All right, great. Okay. One of the problems is that your neighborhood is a bit on the large side. You have 1,000 houses, and I've been given 3,000 seconds to talk about 1,000 houses. So if there's a math teacher in the house, you can tell us how much we have to leave out. And probably all of your houses will be left out given the amount of time. So this neighborhood is pretty far along, as neighborhoods go, in formally preserving the housing and the physical structure of the neighborhood. And you've even gotten the National Register of Historic Places recognition for the neighborhood. And the issue with that is it does take care of the houses, but at this point, you're all curators of the houses, much like a curator in an art museum. You can put paintings up on the wall in a gallery, and if there's no story, people come and they look and they go, well, is this important or not? They don't know. And so what I'm trying to do tonight is to show you houses, people, and stories to let you know of some of the important things that have taken place in your history that I think should be preserved. I was asked how many neighborhoods, this is a quiz show, how many neighborhoods have national landmark recognition? And I thought for a minute, and I said, well, you know, every state probably has half a dozen, maybe one, probably a couple hundred. So I found the answer, and your neighborhood is one of 13,145 neighborhoods in the country that have national landmark recognition. So how are you going to distinguish yourself from 13,144? And it would be, I think, with the stories and the knowledge that this was the part of Milwaukee that the people who founded the most successful businesses in Milwaukee, who became leaders nationally and globally, wanted to make as their neighborhood. And it's also a story of craftsmanship and architecture around the turn of the century. Some of the stories can be told in plaques, like that one of the water tower. Of course, it isn't practical to have 1,000 plaques in your neighborhood. So how do you preserve these stories? Well, we're going to begin here. And you'll say, well, Brian, there's nothing there. And that's true. But there was. And this is what I call ground zero for the transition into a real neighborhood from a settlement kind of on the edge of town where the services weren't too good and where they put the people that had contagious diseases. So I want to show you how we can learn from preserving the houses in the neighborhood that were the glue that actually made it a real neighborhood. So I'm going to start rather bravely with houses that aren't here anymore. Then I'll accelerate pretty quickly on a trip through time to the scene of what we can consider the Big Bang that created your neighborhood. That has nothing to do with Sex and the City. When I first concepted this presentation, I wanted to find the spark that caused the Big Bang. And I found out, turns out, there's not just a metaphorical spark, but there's an actual spark and there's an actual Big Bang. Today, as you know, the Big Bang takes place on the lakefront, and this is a pretty good place to watch the Big Bang. But on the 4th of July in 1889, The Big Bang took place here in the Menominee Valley at the Falk Brewery. So we're in Milwaukee, surprise, 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 we're already talking about a brewery. If you ever get a speaker up here to talk about Milwaukee history, he says, this is where it all began, and he isn't talking about beer. You should throw the bum out. So I didn't want to get thrown out, so I decided I better start off talking about a brewery because this is just west of 27th Street. At the time, it was just outside the city limit. They put it here so they wouldn't have to pay city taxes. See how things change? All right. If you don't know anything about Falk, it was once the fourth largest brewery after all the ones that you know. Generally, nobody knows about Falk anymore. But you can tell from the image that if you owned this pile, you were near the top of the heap of Milwaukee's business leaders and industry leaders. And these are exactly the kind of people who come to settle in your neighborhood. But we've got to get these people from the Menominee Valley onto Terrace Avenue. But first, the brewery was really wildly successful. They won prizes for beer quality, shipping their beer as far as Australia, Singapore, and even India, because they had a way to preserve the beer better than their competitors, you know. And they were really good at fireworks, too. And on the 4th of July, they decided to have a fireworks party to celebrate their success. All of the fireworks went off just as expected, right where they thought they were going to go, except for one spark. This is the spark that creates your neighborhood when it lands in a grain elevator. And immediately, there is a fire that they cannot drain barrels of beer fast enough to put out. They only had beer to fight the fire with. And pretty soon, beer is knee-deep all over the brewery, and the flames destroy the brewery completely.
Oh, wow.
Now, what do they do? Do we have any Germans here besides me? This is Milwaukee. See, everybody raises their hand. Yeah, you're in Milwaukee. Okay. Are Germans stubborn? Did the Germans say, you know, I'm going to give up. Let's turn this place into condos and sell pizza by the slice. Or did they say, we're going to rebuild, it's going to be bigger and better than ever. And so they rebuilt and they made it bigger than ever. And because they were rebuilding, suddenly they had newer equipment than Pabst Brewing. And now they're the leader. And they've got electric motors moving things around. And one day, guess what? One of the electric motors sparks and it starts a fire, and the brewery burns down a second time, within 3 years. Okay, so at that point, they had a little change of heart about what they were going to do. What remains today is this. That's the storage house that we see right there, and this much is all below ground, and all you see is that. And if you say, gosh, Brian, that looks like the Fisker. It's the same architect, or Turner Hall. He did City Hall, Turner Hall, the Pfister. He did this brewery, but that's all that's there. So the Pabst family wanted all this cool equipment. They didn't have a lot of capital, so they paid the Falks in stock certificates. And the Falks wound up having as much stock as the Pabst family. And they had a heyday. They decided to get the hell out of the brewery and come over to the east side. And pretty soon, they were on Terrace. But first, they had to announce their arrival to let people know they were society people, and they had a wedding for their daughter, Emma, at St. John's Cathedral, and they invited all their besties. And do you know how many besties they had? They sent out 1,500 invitations. I don't know how many came, but the Archbishop of Milwaukee presided and immediately realized he was just there to be second fiddle. He had to start out by reading a telegram of congratulations to the bride and groom from no less than the Pope. So, I think I've made the case. I'm not going to go any further. I made the case that the Falks are okay to be considered business leaders who are successful enough that other people are going to move here so that they can be considered successful because they're living by other people's rules. Frankly, that's the story of your neighborhood. So, the mother of the bride, Louisa Falk, has a house built where we started, just to the north of Maria Papp's house. And her son Frank builds a house between Mom and Marie Pabst. But all the folks come, and Emma, who marries Judge Paul Carpenter, moves into this nice Eschweiler on Wyoming Place, right across the street from Mom. What do you know? Babysitting. Okay, so there's more. There's more folks. There's Herman. Herman is, he's the operations guy, the serious German engineer. He doesn't want to take the time to build a house. This house is already there, he just moves in. So he's living just south of what is today Villa Terrace. But he has a brother, Clarence. Clarence wants to live near Herman, so Clarence builds an Eschweiler right across the street from Herman. So, is it any wonder that the locals didn't know that this was Terrace Avenue? Everybody called it Falk Row. Because that's who lived there. But there's another Falk. We didn't cover more. There's one more, Lewis. And Lewis lived here. And you go, what? No, he didn't live there. That's not Lewis's house. Well, no, it isn't Lewis's house. There was a teardown. The house closest to where you're sitting right now was a teardown. How are we doing at historic preservation? We can't save the closest house. Why did they tear it down? Well, Lewis lived there because he liked the proximity to Lake Park. And what he liked to do was ride his sleigh through Lake Park in the winter, just like this. This is Wisconsin Avenue around 13th Street. That's now all torn down so that it can be Marquette University. So Lewis was speeding through Lake Park one day, and in the excitement, he had a heart attack. And he fell out of the sleigh, and he died right in Lake Park, doing what he loved to do, riding his sleigh. So what happens if you fall out of your sleigh? They tear your house down, and no one will ever know you live there. And the Galoons of the tannery, who married a Pritzloff, everybody's related, move in. How are we doing? Oh, there's still another Falk. Louisa died. She was the matriarch that brought everybody over. She died in 1898. No problem. Her son Otto hadn't moved in anywhere yet. So Otto moved in to Mom's house. Now, let's keep all that straight. Here we are looking at the old pumping station. There is Villa Terrace. There's Herman's house, Villa Terrace, Hilda Pabst, Maria Pabst. There's Franz's house between Mom and Marie. And this is Louisa Falk, now Otto Falk's house. That's, of course, the Smith. But Clarence is right there. And then there's Emma. And Lewis is just kind of up the street. So that's Falk Row. If we go in a little bit further, you can see even better what something used to be there, where we started. Herman, Villa Terrace, Hilda, Marie, Frank, and Otto, and Mrs. Otto now. Okay? So, that's Mrs. Otto Falk, but that is the home of Louisa Falk, which got turned into landfill, because that's what we do. And that was a ferry in class. And I found out that they tore George Ferry's house down too. He didn't even fall out of his sleigh. So there was a reason that this house got torn down and turned into parkland. And the reason is that a will specified that when the owners died, the house would revert to the Milwaukee Park Commission, because Louisa Falk's maiden name was Louisa Wall. And her brother had something to do, I don't know what, with Lake Park and Wall Avenue, and his name was Christian Wall. So they wanted it all to serve the memory of the family, and it disappeared. But why tear down just two houses? Why not bulldoze an entire subdivision? Let's do that. If we go just south, by the way, there are the two houses that I just referenced, okay, in the pumping station. This is an 1898 map of Terrace, and there's a whole subdivision down here called Woodland Court. And that's where George Ferry of Ferry and Klaus, who did so much for the city and got nothing, lived. And they bulldozed all that, turned it into landfill. Terrace Place became Back Bay, and as you know, that became Back Bay Park. But it was an entire subdivision. Right here is a house that we're going to show next, where the Brumders moved into the neighborhood. Everybody knows the Brumders, right? They weren't there from the beginning, but by 1904, the Brumders are living in this house right at the top of Lafayette Hill and Lake Drive, where today the plaque marks the Water Tower Landmark Association. If anybody doesn't know, the Brumders were associated with the Germania Building and Germania Publishing, which was the absolute largest publisher of German language books and materials anywhere in the world except for Berlin, and they lived in your neighborhood. So I'm trying to make the point that business leaders choose your neighborhood, but they all know each other and they make it a real neighborhood. What about Hilda? They call this the Gustav Patch House. No, it's the Hilda House, because Hilda had the money. She had the purse strings. And Hilda and Gustav, well, of course, this is another Ferry and Klaus. George Ferry did this beautiful house. He tore his house down. But Hilda and Gustav get married at a place called Vendor. And so by this time, Gustav is not working for Pabst. He's in the real estate business, and he starts a real estate company called Ventnor. And why Ventnor? It's because there is a resort on the Isle of Wight that was favored by Queen Victoria as a place to cool off in the summer, and Hilda wanted to get married there. So does that make the Falk wedding look like it's done on the weed plant? So Gustav and Hilda Lemke from a very posh St. Louis Broom family get married on the Isle of Wight, and he calls his real estate company Ventnor. And where's the real estate that he's selling? It's basically the Washington Highlands. Okay? And he's telling people through Ventnor that the ultimate, most prestigious place to live in the area is the Washington Highlands, but he himself isn't living there. He's living in your neighborhood, if that says anything about the best neighborhood to be in. Okay, the first house on Wall Avenue belongs to a real leader of business, Mr. Kern, Mr. John Kern. There was no other house on Wall Avenue at this time. What did Mr. Kern do? At this time, Milwaukee is the big port shipping wheat, and of course, they're turning wheat into flour, and he has one of the largest flour mills in the nation on the Milwaukee River called the John Kern Flouring Mills. So where did this flour mill come from? Suppose we went just a few feet away in this place called Lake Park and we saw this. What is the connection for $64,000 between Erastus B. Walcott and John Kern's flour mill? Well, doctors like to put their money somewhere. And Erastus B. Walcott was an investor who funded the flour mill. So there is a connection between this, John Kern's house, and the largest flour mill in the country. And what the thing tells you is that he was the first guy to successfully remove a kidney and have the patient live. What the fine print tells you is the patient died 10 days later, but he did survive the operation. Okay. So when I see this statue, I don't know what you think of. Maybe that, you know, cool sculpture. Here's what I think of. That if I'm having a kidney removed by this guy, I want an appointment in the morning. Because if it's in the afternoon, he might have to hurry up and get to a board meeting at a flour mill. So what happens, as you know, because there's a picture of this right over there, streetcar. Everything old is new again. We're getting a streetcar. Well, they got a streetcar, and what happened? It packed Lake Park with people. Nobody lived around here. There weren't any sewers or plumbing, but because of the streetcar, you had Pokemon. And these look like people that are well behaved. They've got really nice picnic baskets, they've got embroidered towels, and underneath those towels, they've got bottles of beer. And as soon as the sun goes down, they start drinking, they're making noise, they're trampling the shrubs, you can't control them, and what happens? John Kern sticks his head out the window late at night, and even though he's still the only house on Wall Avenue, he shouts, "I can't stand the crowds anymore. I'm gonna move to a farm up north." And 1 year after this gorgeous house is built, he's out of there because it's too crowded. And where does he go up north? Well, this is 1901, and up north was just south of Capitol Drive. On the Milwaukee River, between the Milwaukee River and Humboldt, and his farm today is Kern Park. And that's John Kern. The people who built these houses, who were leaders, needed to show that they had taste. And so they hired fine architects and very fine artists and interior decorators. And George Mann Nedekin was among the finest, and he lived in your neighborhood. And he walked right past where we are, as real as can be. I don't like the fact that Nedekin is often portrayed as some second fiddle to Frank Lloyd Wright, because he was working in your neighborhood making very fine work before Wright discovered him. Wright didn't discover Nedekin. Somebody from your neighborhood did. But believe it or not, Nedekin goes off to Europe to study. So people got around in those days. And he's studying with Alphonse Mucha, the great Czech artist. And Mucha's contribution to the art world, of course, is to invent Art Nouveau. And Nedekin studies Art Nouveau with Mucha until, unfortunately, Nedekin's father dies and he has to come back to Milwaukee. And he races back breathless and he makes the rounds of the architects and says, "Guess what's happening in Paris?" And you know what the architect said? "Who cares? This is Milwaukee. We don't need to keep up with Paris. We don't need to worry about that for quite a while. Why don't you just kind of sit on your hands?" So Nedekin gets a job teaching art on Jefferson at the Milwaukee Art Institute until a lady from your neighborhood decides, you know, this guy needs something to do. Maybe he's creative. I'll let him decorate the interior of my house. Well, almost everything on the screen so far gets torn down. And so this was unfortunately next to the Leighton Art Gallery, and the city thought that this would make good landfill and they could put up a parking lot. So they tore down the Leighton Art Gallery and the Milwaukee Institute of Art in one fell swoop. Fortunately, Nedekin got work on Wall Avenue at the Emma Urey Demmer House. How many of you have friends in Chicago or Oak Park? Yeah. You get tired of them talking about Frank Lloyd Wright and how great all of this stuff is. This is something that I think we need to shout about from the rooftops, because Nedekin's first commission was not in Oak Park, it was not in Chicago, it was not for Frank Lloyd Wright. It hadn't been discovered yet. The person who caught on to the talent of George Mann Nedekin was Herman Benning and his partner Gustav Dick, who was a real arts and crafts guy. The two of them designed this house based on Benning's work with Stanford White, and they get a master builder and mason by the name of Henry Danishevsky, who does St. Mary's Hospital and almost everything else in the city, like the big breweries that we saw. Here's a view from the front. And this house is great enough that it actually has a plaque that tells the kind of story that everyone needs to know. Mentions Henry Danishevsky, Gustav Dick, Herman Benning, what Nedekin did on the interior, that Nedekin, here's the important word, later worked for Frank Lloyd Wright. And so people from Chicago need to hear that word, later worked for Frank Lloyd Wright. And I think the important sentence is that the house stands as a testament to the skill and artistry of craftsmen at the turn of the 20th century. That's what all of this architecture in the neighborhood is. It isn't just the drawings and the architects. It's the craftsmen that were able to actually execute what otherwise would have only been paper houses. Nedekin did more work on Wall Avenue, this time for Adam Meyer, the treasurer of the Meyer Boot Company. And if you know Schlitz Park on Pleasant, it's a gigantic brick building just north of Schlitz Park called the Fortress. And that was the Meyer Boot Company. They were also on St. Paul and Water Street. So this is where the patronage is coming from. Very wealthy owners of manufacturing industry and business that want to show others that they not only have money, they have taste, and they can afford the best. Nedekin works with another arts and crafts architect by the name of Cornelius Leenouts and does this gorgeous house on Summit. It's a duplex in 1911. By this time, Nedekin is living three houses away from Leenouts, so everybody's doing the networking thing. In 1910 and 1911, George Mann Nedekin is living in this house on Newberry Boulevard, not downstairs, but he's renting the upstairs. This is what it's like to work for Frank Lloyd Wright. You don't get paid. So he becomes a neighbor of Herman Beming, who's living a few houses to the east of him. They can literally converse with each other every day. So after 2 years on Newberry, Nedekin moves to Marietta, to the Marietta Apartments. And in the day, those were some of the finest luxury apartments in Milwaukee, because Martin Telgren, that's what he did. If you think the Schrader Hotel, that's Martin Telgren. So great start, but Nedekin lived there all his life. And when you compare that to Frank Lloyd Wright's Taliesin and Taliesin West, you go, wait a minute. Something's out of balance here. And what's out of balance is that Nedekin has to sue Wright several times to be able to have the money just to pay his rent to stay in an apartment building. But Nedekin is definitely in your neighborhood all his life and doing work here. Here is one of the more interesting stories of your neighborhood. Caleb Johnson in this gorgeous house on Bradford. Caleb Johnson had a dull life as a soap manufacturer. The soaps that he was making were made out of lye. And they weren't very exciting, they were rough, they were ugly, and he wasn't all that excited about his life. And one winter, it was so dreary in Milwaukee, imagine that, that he left for Florida. And when he went down to Florida, instead of going deep sea fishing with Hemingway, he walked around looking at all the soaps there. And he discovered that the soaps down there were different, that some were made of coconut oil, some were made of olive oil, and some were made of palm oil. And he comes back to Milwaukee, and he works in the basement for a while until he comes up with a new formula that combines palm oil and olive oil, and it becomes the Palm Olive Company from your neighborhood, from Lake Drive, from that house. Now, I don't want you to leave your seats, but we have to take a short break. Let's take a short break to hear a word from our sponsor. This presentation tonight on Water Tower Neighbors is being brought to you by the Palm Olive Soap Company of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where better ideas for luxurious bathing come to you from the beautiful Water Tower neighborhood. Ladies, do you dream of your husband worshiping you like Cleopatra? Join the many goddesses who reach for a bar of palm olive soap the next time you are in your historic tiled bath. Soon, you'll imagine yourself on your royal barge being rowed down the Milwaukee River by hundreds of hump-type slaves as you travel toward the harbor entrance to greet the sun god Ra rising over a Lake Michigan.
Palm olive soap, invented by Caleb Johnson in the Water Tower neighborhood.
For all the Cleopatras and Pharaohs, your name.
And now back to our show, ladies and gentlemen, coming to you live from the Marsha Coles Community Room in beautiful Lake Park, designed in 1892 and a national landmark since 1993. Well, Caleb Johnson brought back the Florida influence. It's kind of a restrained Addison Meisner effort from Boca Raton or Palm Beach, and he moves. And how far do people move in the Water Tower neighborhood when they build a new house? He goes across the street, that's right. Diagonally, but essentially, he moved across the street into a new house. And this house overlooks Lake Michigan. He can pretend that he's in Boca Raton looking at the ocean while working hard on new formulations of soap. Well, the company grows and grows and grows, and soon they need a new headquarters. And this is what happens. They have to create the Palm Olive Building in Chicago. Now, those Chicago friends that you have that you're kind of tired of hearing about Chicago architecture, you tell them, oh yeah, yeah, I've heard of Chicago architecture, but did you know that some of your most important buildings only exist because of somebody from Milwaukee? That without Caleb Johnson, there would have been no Palm Olive Building, no place to put the Lindbergh Beacon? My, oh my, oh my. Well, how much furniture do you think it takes to put furniture in the Palm Olive Building, and where do you get it? Do you go down the street to some stranger in Chicago that might rip you off? Or do you go to your neighbors? Caleb Johnson walks down Lake Drive, a few houses, has a chat and a cigar with his neighbor, who happens to own the Marshall Furniture Company, right in this house. And the Marshall Furniture Company provides the furniture for all of the Palm Olive Building, because he wanted to deal and do business with his neighbors. Not only do they furnish the Palm Olive Building, but this was the time of the competition for the Tribune Tower. The Tribune Tower needed furniture. The Marshall Furniture Company provides the furniture for the Tribune Tower. But wait, there's more. The Palmer House needs furniture, and they provide the furniture for the Palmer House. So when you walk past a house and you go, well, I don't know if anything interesting happened in that house. If it's in this neighborhood, something interesting happened in that house. All right. Talk about cars for a minute. Jeff, you've seen this. I've studied this postcard forever. It's really interesting. It has to be an immigrant German artist because they're talking about the Ringstrasse, the steering wheel's on the wrong side of the car, all kinds of odd things about this. It just isn't America. So I discover the other odd thing is that this is a family. There's the husband, you know, the wife and the two kids. And who's this guy? He's wearing a chauffeur's cap. And at first, I thought, yeah, it's the chauffeur because the guy probably hasn't learned how to drive yet. But no. I'm going to tell you the secret. That is a real estate developer. And there's a lot of empty lots on Newbury. And he's taking this family around and showing them, you can build here, you can build there. And he's looking, where's he looking? He's looking at the bowling green in Lake Park. And he's saying, you know, we've got a lawn bowling association. And if you decide to build on one of these lots, I'm going to introduce you to E.J. Brunder. That just shows how long the Brunders have been around here. So, we have to tell a very important story about a very important car and a very important event that connects your neighborhood. How many of you, this is not by any means just to test your intellect or anything, but I'm just curious how much history has been lost. Raise your hand if you've ever heard of Carl Ritter. Yeah, so I know. Okay, so Gina, did you raise your hand? Okay. Carl Ritter is kind of a little too early. This is his retirement party in 1932. But he's a real connected guy. He's a Southern German
The family is extremely wealthy. He builds these, designs houses on Newberry Boulevard, on Summit, on Shepherd. And his family back in Germany is very, very close to him. And boy, do they have money. And if only one person heard of Carl Ringer, nobody heard of Carl Ringer's sister. But in the Water Tower neighborhood in the day, everybody in the neighborhood knew about Carl Ringer's sister, Bertha, back in Germany, Bertha Ringer. Because Bertha Ringer is Bertha Ringer Benz, and she's known around the world as a badass. And her husband is no less than Carl Benz, as in Daimler Benz, as in Mercedes. Carl Benz is the brother-in-law of an architect working in your neighborhood. The Ringer's money finances Carl Benz. He's a guy with absolutely no business sense. He has a steel construction company, and Bertha's dowry gets wasted in his steel construction company, which is going down the tubes because Carl is really a tinkerer. And he spends his time on an invention which he patents, but which he figures is totally useless, called the Motorwagen. And he becomes filled with self-doubt. And he goes through a bout of deep depression because he can't figure out who would want one of these things. And Bertha, meanwhile, is just about at her wit's end. The family money is almost gone, and all that Carl is doing is getting depressed and napping. So what does Bertha do? She says, screw it, I'm gonna fix this. And she becomes the first car thief, the first person in the world to steal a car. Not the first woman, the first man or woman to steal a car. And here she is stealing the car. This is the first car theft. While her husband is sleeping, Carl Ringer's sister has her two sons quietly push the car out of the garage and a distance away from the house so that they can start the engine without Carl waking up. And she decides that she is going to become the inventor of the road trip. And she takes the first road trip in automobiling history by driving to her mother's house, 66 miles away. It takes all day. And she arrives there almost at night, figures she better tell Carl what happened to the car. She sends him a telegram. She says, it's okay, I'm at mom's. The boys are safe. We're all fine. We're having dinner. Sorry, but had to do this. And he telegrams back right away, and he says, I've already heard about your trip. Everyone on the way saw the car, and now everybody wants one. And because of Bertha's ride, it creates a demand for automobiles. And the way that they preserve this history in Germany that could be a lesson for your neighborhood is they create the Bertha Benz Memorial Route. And to this day, they plan antique car rallies where you can take your antique car and follow the route that Bertha took to her mother's house. And we won't go further into the story, but if you have time on the YouTube channel, there's a series of stories about famous women called My Girl Heroes. Check the segment on Bertha Benz. She was the first car thief who made the first road trip and the brother of Carl Ringer in your neighborhood. Cars also come to your neighborhood in a very unwanted way. Did you know that there was a Ford auto plant at the edge of your neighborhood? Well, in 1916, Henry Ford makes a proposal to the city of Milwaukee for an automotive assembly plant right at the edge of the Water Tower neighborhood. And the neighborhood goes bananas, not in a positive way, but all of the real estate developers, the real estate agents, and the people who are speculating on the value of the land, they say, are you kidding? What's going to happen to the value of my house if we have a noisy car plant? And they run to City Hall, there's a raucous meeting, And what does the city council say? They say, well, you know, this could create a lot of jobs. It could bring a lot of traffic to Prospect. Why, who knows? You might even be able to find a suntanning booth and get some pizza by the slice and all kinds of things that you need right there. And darn, they lose. And Ford, because Henry Ford, they figure he's got such deep pockets, he won't default on the taxes. And they proclaim it a win-win. And the next thing you know, they're assembling Model Ts in this place. And the only part of the building that looks like it's possibly an automotive plant is the parking level. And if you look at the pillars and how they flare out at the top, they're designed to support enormously heavy loads on the flooring, such as the assembly of the Model T. And they start at the top of the building. They put the cars in elevators to take them down for the successive operations. And all of the Model Ts in Wisconsin are made at the edge of your neighborhood. Today, if you go through, it's the Peck School of the Arts, and it's almost impossible to recognize anything like a Model T plant except for the parking level. Now, if I said, can anybody take me to this sign, who could take me there? One, two. All right, that's it. Okay, all right. Well, believe it or not, when I show you where this is, all of you are going to know where it is. And how can that be? It's Boswell Books. Yeah. So, Boswell Books, BD, that means before Daniel, was of course Webster's, but before that, it was a very important place, and it was the reason the Ford plant came close to your neighborhood. It was the Milwaukee Motor School. It was where you went to learn all about your car, just like learning how to use the Apple IIe or something. They went here, and you could become, if you send that coupon in, you'll get a booklet, how you can be the master of your automobile. And it's for people who also want to open a dealership. And pretty soon, Downer Avenue is full of automotive dealerships. You get a free set of tools if you send that coupon in, but hurry. Okay, because this is just about over. So if you have a Tesla or a Prius, it's not really that new. There was a car called the Detroit Electra that was sold on Downer Avenue. And Jeff, you just mentioned Stone Creek Coffee. That address happens to translate to where Stone Creek Coffee is, but that entire row of storefronts once was a place to take your car to get it serviced or to park it because nobody had a garage. And that was Gasoline Alley, so to speak, except there's no gasoline in this car. But the car is very popular. Why? Because it has a top and it's fully enclosed. You can go cruising down the street in the rain and the snow and stay perfectly dry. But more important, it's electric. There is no clutch. You don't have to learn to operate a clutch. You don't shift any gears. You want to go faster, you press harder on the pedal. It's a sensation. And maybe you've heard this, and a lot of people in the neighborhood that had an electric car, it was the Anderson Electric. And who the hell was Anderson Electric? It was a cooperation between Henry Ford, who did the car, and Thomas Edison, who took care of the batteries and electric motor. Do you think you can trust a couple guys like that to make an electric car? Well, we've still got some lots to fill up here on Newberry Boulevard. Look at this. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. In 1910, one-third of the lots on Newberry Boulevard have no neighbors. They have no houses. What's going on? I don't know the whole story, but I believe the deeds had restrictions on having stables. Because if you're going from one beautiful Frederick Law Olmsted Park to another Frederick Law Olmsted Park, do you want to smell horse manure? No. So they took care of that by outlawing stables, which pretty much took care of people buying houses on Newberry Boulevard. How do I know that? Because in 1921, well, first of all, 1910, we can see that there are houses. But in 1921, Maynard and Pickett is desperately trying to unload lots on Newberry Boulevard. So 1921, they haven't solved the Newberry Boulevard problem.
One house that was on Newberry Boulevard
belongs to a famous Milwaukeean by the name of Frederick Schrader, who is the son of John Schrader, who is as much a lumber baron as you can imagine. Mr. Schrader had a lumber camp in a town named after him, Schrader, up on Lake Superior. And they would send the logs down the Great Lakes, come in the Menominee River to the Burnham Canal. And here you see the John Schrader Lumber Company. But if you think making lumber is dull, wait till you hear this. Has anybody heard of Lucille King? Anybody a school teacher? Lucille King was a school teacher. She got tired of being a school teacher. She decided to make educational toys. And she went to work for John Schrader with the idea that you could make toys out of wood that were educational. And John Schrader said, you know, that's a pretty cool idea. Let's get somebody to endorse these. They took the toys to Psychology Today. And they got psychologists to endorse the toys to say, you know, these really are beneficial. For your child to play with this, your child will develop motor skills, your child will be smarter, your child will get ahead because they are playing school. And they formed the Play School Institute. So how come all this neighborhood history, how come everybody isn't like, yeah, Brian, tell us something we don't know. Toys for men, toys for young girls. The Play School Institute, first on Commerce Street, then on Walnut, which is now Schlitz Park. And again, just like Palm Mall of Soap, now we've got Play School. So this is why I'm saying the Water Tower neighborhood is the home of the inventors, the businesses, the industrials, the people that are moving and shaking the country. And here's another one. This is a great story about how you sell real estate in 1920. And this is the Elder Maggie house. And so let's say that, you know, I meet you on the street corner and you go, Brian, what can you tell me about this house? And well, you know, it's the Elder Maggie house. Fred Graff designed it. He's got a lot of beautiful homes in the neighborhood. This one's from 1902. And you go, oh. The last thing you should say in this neighborhood is, oh. Why? Because there's always more to the story. It's never just, oh. You should ask a leading question like, so, was the house always on this lot? And I would say, well, you must have come to that lecture at the Marsha Coles Community because no, it wasn't on this lot. So we have to learn some new terminology. We're going to learn the term flipping a house. You think you know what it means to flip a house? This house was flipped 180 degrees from where it used to be. That's how we flipped houses in the Water Tower neighborhood. And 1920. Okay, so beautiful place. It looks like it was always there, but don't be fooled. Okay, so how did it get there? This beautiful house. People say this, some people say this is their favorite house on Wall Avenue over in Milwaukee. The Lueck House of Lueck Ice Cream. Did you know that Lueck changed the world of ice cream for everybody? Does anybody eat ice cream at home? Do you know it's because of this house? Lueck invented a press which could press ice cream into a very solid block that you could carry home without it melting, and he suddenly obsoleted the concept of the ice cream powder. And everybody thought the world was coming to an end, but now we take eating ice cream at home for granted. And this is another thing that you should know about that happened in the neighborhood.
So what happened? So the Elder Maggie house used to be right here. It used to face the lake on Wall Avenue. And so the Lewicks went inside and they said, the feng shui here is perfect, but we don't like the house. So they sold the house to a Mr. Wirth and they said, if you want it,
You can't keep it here. You got to take it somewhere. Take it with you. So Mr. Wirth took the house. They flipped it 180 degrees, which created some space in the backyard to put another house.
And now we're going to learn how everybody's related in the neighborhood.
You should never say, are A and B related? No. You should ask, how are A and B related?
Because, watch this, we're going to go to late, whoops, okay. Here's a relation. So, gosh, it's hard to remember. Lewick's wife's father is Stephen Hoff
of Hackett Hoff and Tierman, meaning they are the Prospect Hill Land Company. They are the subdivision of Prospect Hill, which is practically everything across the street from Lake Park, from Kenwood down to Park Place. They're related to the Lewicks.
So, just as we saw a house from 1900 on Wall Avenue, here's a house from 1900 on Lake Drive.
Gorgeous house by Robert Messmer, who's the son of Henry Messmer. And the man who owns the house is a Swiss immigrant named Peter Brodesser, who makes conveyor belts because all of these factories need to move things around, and he becomes very wealthy. And one day he thinks, I'm taking a conveyor belt and turning it vertically so that it becomes an elevator. And he forms the Brodesser Elevator Company and becomes very wealthy. And he has a son, Roman, who starts making pies at Margaret Lewick, the daughter of the Lewicks, at that nice house. And they get married. And they need a place to live, so what do? They call up Thomas Stevens Van Alia, and they say, what about a house? And Thomas Stevens Van Alia puts a house next to the ice cream folks, who are over here. There's the house that got flipped, okay, because the feng shui was better over here. And Roman and Margaret are living next door to mom and dad and the mother-in-law, and the marriage doesn't last very long. I guess they were too close. It was all too convenient. Here is a guy who did not live in your neighborhood because he died before he could move here. But his sons become builders on Lake Drive. And the story of John Ruggie, real fast, is he's the most vertically integrated businessman in the history of Milwaukee, or probably anywhere. And I'll tell you how vertically integrated he was. He owned forests in Grand Haven, where they cut down the trees, so he's got the raw material. They bring the trees into the Burnham Canal to surprise the Ruggie Lumber Yard, and out come dimension lumber and boards, which he turns into windows for your house, doors, cabinets, flooring, shingles. Oh, do you need somebody to design the house? He's an architect. You need somebody to build it? He's a builder. Do you need a permit and permission to build? He's the alderman. Is anybody going to give you static? If so, he's no fooler. He's the Milwaukee sheriff. And so that there's no interference from the state, he's a state legislator. So he's got it all covered.
But before he can get to Lake Drive, he comes down with some infectious disease, and he figures, I got to go where the air is better than on Menominee Valley, and he goes to Redlands, California, in San Bernardino County, to try to recover at a spot, and he dies there. Body is brought back to Milwaukee and buried at Forest Home. But he has several sons. John Ruggie Jr. puts up this house on the corner of Lake Drive and Bellevue, and he would have liked his father to have built it, but his father died a few years before. So what does he do? He calls up Herman Benning, and that should say Gustav Dick as well, who did the Demmer House, the Nedekin and all that, that was built by Danishevsky. Danishevsky becomes the builder and the mason. He's the greatest mason in Milwaukee, and he institutes this house with Romanburg. And this house talks to you if you know what it's saying. The Prairie School hadn't yet appeared in Milwaukee, but they were trying out how to make Prairie School buildings with Romanburg in this house, which is not a Prairie style house. So they had to have Henry Danishevsky do the brickwork. John Ruggie Jr. chose all the wood for the interior. It's an absolutely marvelous house. He has a brother, Frederick, who lives across the street. Frederick moves into the house of architect Charles Crane. We talked about Charles Crane with Crane's work for Caleb Johnson, and also that first house on Wall Avenue where the man couldn't take all the nice of the city. This is the house of Charles Crane. Crane only lives in it for 2 years, and Frederick Ruggie lives there. Now, here's my favorite photo of the night. Frederick Ruggie sits down on the porch to have his picture taken in early 1907, on the day he moves in. And look what you can see from his porch. If you look over his shoulder, this is Lake Drive in Bellevue. We're looking northeast. There is the North Point Lighthouse. From Lake Drive and Bellevue to North Point Lighthouse, there is goose egg. Nothing. You can see why Lewis liked to ride his sleigh. Okay. Bringing houses in the way. Okay, so I wondered, because one of the pillars on the house is missing today, but I had to figure out, was that really the same house? Could it be? So being kind of an analytical guy, I find a Sanborn map, and there is where Frederick Ruggie is sitting. There's John's house, and if you go up through this angle, the lighthouse would be right there, except this funky house is in the way, and I learned that this house appears in 1908. So in 1907, it wasn't there. There was a direct line of sight from Frederick's house to the North Point Lighthouse. And we can prove it by overlaying a satellite image today. There's where Ruggie's sitting on the porch, goes all the way up through there, straight to the lighthouse, and this whole entire block, except for his brother John's house and the Trostel Mansion, there ain't nothing. And why? Why does this side of Lake Drive have all these houses on it and nobody's on the other side? Anybody have a guess? Because I honestly don't know. Okay, nobody knows. Bob?
I think there was a ravine between the backyards of the lots that are empty. Maybe it needed to be filled?
Well, it would have to be in that picture.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a ravine. I don't know. Okay. It's a good theory. Thanks, Jeff. All right. So there is how you can see the lighthouse in 1907 without going there. Well, the car, there's Frederick's car in 1909. He's parked on Bellevue. He's facing west. That's his daughter, Betty. And this row house is green today on the upper level. It was built in 1909. The house next to it is an Eschweiler from 1910, so we can be pretty sure that Frederick is sitting there in 1909. Now, Frederick decides that this is going to break your heart, that there are better places than the water tower. He's also working in the Menominee Valley. He is the treasurer for Nordberg Corporation. But Daddy took the kids on trips to buy hardwoods and lumber, and they would go to places like Colorado to look at trees, and they would go to California. And Frederick gets the California itch, and he builds a house, ready for this, on Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood that is a mission-style house. And they pack up the house to go to Hollywood. They load the entire house into a railroad. Follow the railroad car to Hollywood. And you might say, how do you get from Lake Drive to Hollywood in 1919? What kind of car would be suitable to drive in? Well, I'm going to show you. How about a 1919 Chandler 6? That's exactly, yeah, the Chandler 6, sure. Because it's the Lexus of the day in that it has the best enclosure and the best suspension. And if you don't believe they drove this car, here they are stopping next to the only tree in New Mexico to catch some shade and have a picture taken. You can see that Betty's a little bit older than when she was standing up in the car in Bellevue. And she's kind of got that look on her face that says, you know, but when are we going to be there?
Yeah.
Are we there yet? So Florence, the woman on the left, actually kept a diary of the trip. And I talked to the great-grandson who has the diary and wants to recreate the trip and come out to Milwaukee, tracing the footsteps of Florence. When they get to Hollywood, Frederick comes down with influenza, and he dies. So Florence puts everything back into a railroad car, sends the railroad car back to Milwaukee, follows the railroad car into Chandler 6, and it turns out that she knows Mrs. Demmer on Wall Avenue. And she's a friend of Mrs. Edward Schrader, and her husband builds the Schrader Hotel, but another great apartment complex is going up on Astor. It's very luxurious, called the Astor Apartments. And she moves in to the Astor Apartments, which is today the Astor Hotel. Who's this? Who's this pretty lady? What's she doing? She's making life miserable for people in Milwaukee who are in the liquor business and who are making beer. Yeah, yeah, so that was her thing. And the Anti-Saloon League had this thing. And wouldn't that make you want to give up liquor? Now, we don't have time to, unfortunately, we don't have time, we're just about done, to go into the whole story of what happens in the Water Tower neighborhood during Prohibition, what do you think happens? Prohibition, the best definition that I ever heard was, it's a time when nobody stayed home. Because. So, Cary Nation starts to impact people in the liquor business, like Elizabeth Black. And 2 years ago, I was lucky to research the life and the home of Elizabeth Black, who lived on Terrace, across from Back Bay Park. And she was a very extraordinarily wealthy heiress and a very generous philanthropist, one of the greatest philanthropists in Milwaukee. She gave a lot to Catholic charities. She had a university degree. She was highly educated. She was a global traveler. She had been everywhere. She was also a very close acquaintance of General Douglas in America. Because when her nephew dies in France in World War I, she receives a letter of condolence from General MacArthur that begins, "Dearly." People in your neighborhood were connected to everything. This is her father, the Honorable John Black. He was a mayor of Milwaukee as well as a state senator. He gave so much money around Milwaukee that the bell tower at St. John's Cathedral is his money. That's Daddy. He is a liquor wholesaler, which means he's one of the wealthiest people in the city. You can tell this by going to the cemeteries, and when you see the absolute largest monument in the cemetery, you know that's a liquor wholesaler. So the family is in the liquor business, and Cary Nation is a serious threat. And so this produces very odd politics. This is Elizabeth's second house. She had lived in an Eschweiler on Prospect, but moved into this house designed by Thomas Stevens Van Allie in the French provincial style that you might expect, because Thomas Stevens Van Allie spent a lot of time after World War I in France studying architecture. So Elizabeth did something very strange for a very progressive woman, and that is she came out against the right to vote program. She was a member of the Wisconsin Association Opposed to Suffrage, along with names like Mrs. Estabrook and Mrs. Thwaites, and there were many people who saw the danger of giving women the right to vote because they knew that the first thing that women would vote on was prohibition. So Elizabeth had to choose between what she wanted to do and what she had to do to save the family business. And although I'm sure she wanted to vote, she worked to prevent giving women the right to vote. So those are the strange things that went on in the Nevada. one last important citizen of the neighborhood, then we'll quickly wind up. Harriet Erling Finch, who lived on Back Bay. Again, we're talking leaders. Erling, her father, is Albert J. Erling, the president of a railroad that is major enough to be known as the Milwaukee Road. This is his daughter. And she is the society leader of the East Side. And this article was written just after she died, shows what the home looked like before her remodeling, before she hires Herman Benning. And she is called the society leader. So this means, and I wish we had time to get into it, but we don't, that during Prohibition, she was the entertainer. But she needed to remodel the house to entertain. And so they had to instigate what they called a basement remodeling project. And the way that they did the basement remodeling planning was to take a cruise. And I said that it's the business leaders who hire the architects. The architects don't just put up these gorgeous houses. They aren't built on spec. They're built custom for somebody's specific needs, and they take a cruise, as this shows, to Havana, Cuba. Of all times, can you imagine going to Havana in February instead of August? So this shows that the SS Cuba is traveling from the port of Havana, Cuba to Key West. And on board is Harriet Finch, her husband. So it shows Harriet, her husband Lawrence, and there is your neighbor on Newbury, Herman Benning, and his wife Gertrude. And they go down to Havana during Prohibition to get away from Prohibition, to plan the basement remodeling. Now, why would you want Herman Benning to do a basement remodeling project during Prohibition? Well, Herman Benning had been the chief draftsman at Pabst Brewing. His father worked for Gerlach Malting, who supplied the malt to Pabst. He also happened to be a Ivy League fraternity boy who knew how to throw a party. So they had a planning session, and when they came back, Harriet gave Herman Benning and Alexander Guth the green light to create something known as the Tavern. And this is really special. It's in the architecture publications. This is, I believe, 1922. So upstairs, the women are smoking cigarettes and they're playing cards. And downstairs, you have this room which looks like an Irish tavern from the 18th, 1700s, and there is a gigantic chandelier, can only be Cyril Kolnick, and it's all meant to look like a place where neighbors can get together informally and relax and have an adult beverage. And so here we see a page from a magazine that every architect in the United States is subscribing to called The Architect. That says May 1926, and it says, the tavern room, Mrs. Lawrence Finch. Lawrence is dead by now. Bankers didn't live long, had heart attacks. Mrs. Lawrence Finch, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And there is the upper level, the game room and the gallery. Here is a theater organ, so that the noise that 200 people having adult beverages might make can't be heard. You can pretend everyone has come to an organ concert. And the organ would have come from the neighborhood, from the Lutherans on Marietta. Everybody's doing business with their friends and relatives. So that's the tavern room. Prohibition happens to come at the same time as the Great Depression. It's one of my last stories. Philip Caron builds this house right across from where we are right now. He is the largest producer in the world of concrete mixers and pavers, and he's hit harder than anybody by the Great Depression. And he's so desperate that he borrows $50,000 in 1930 from a friend who had $50,000 during the Depression to lend, probably somebody from the Water Tower neighborhood. And he goes around the country and he tells people, it's all in your mind.
If we get to work, if we start pouring concrete, building roads, and putting up roads, we can get out of this depression, and it'll be over before you know it. When he comes home without a single worker. And he can't pay back the friend's $50,000, and goes out into a field, and that's suicide in the shop. So not all of the stories, even the ones close to here, have happy endings. But one happy ending, last house, and that's Terrace Avenue, not Lake Drive. There was a time when everybody wore a straw hat. And the first person to build a hat factory outside of New York City was Lester Slocum. And this was the upper end of straw hats. This is when Milwaukee led the world of fashion, if you can imagine. There was even a straw hat day where once the weather became warm, you never know what month that's going to happen in Milwaukee. They have straw hat day. You're not allowed to wear a winter hat anymore. Everybody parades in their straw hat to say spring. That's where it comes from. So we come back finally to the end, to where we began. And I'd like to say just a few words about coming back to where we began, to sum up the idea of Fleming's prehistory and what happens. And then this is a work from 1942 by T.S. Eliot. And it's very appropriate if you're out walking in the neighborhood and you happen to walk by St. Francis. What I'd like to leave you with is, if you came this way, taking the route you would be likely to take from the place you would be likely to come from, if you came this way in May time, you would find the hedges white again in May with voluptuary sweetness. And what you thought you came for is only a shell, a husk of meaning. What we call the beginning is often the end. And to make an end is to make a beginning. The end is where we start from. A people without history is not redeemed from time, for history is a pattern of timeless moments. We shall not cease from exploration. And the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and to know the place for the first time. Thank you. Do we have a few minutes for questions?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. That was really fabulous. So, yeah, if anyone has any questions.
I might not be able to answer them, but you can ask. Yes, Mark.
I bought a postcard a few weeks ago at a postcard show, and it was taken from what I think is the top of St. Mary's Hospital. Looking south, you saw the...
Yes, I know that exactly.
Behind it, there are cows in a pasture.
Yes.
I wonder if you were saying why there wasn't any land. That was farmland.
No, those cows belonged to the nuns who worked in the hospital. That was their milk supply. That's the true story. I'm not making this up. That was the nuns' herd.
That's interesting.
What was the date again of that first call family that moved in? What was the year?
1895.
Thank you.
When did automobiles become popular? Because the home that I live in, the garage was built later. The house was built in 1909, but the garage wasn't put on until like the 20s.
Yeah, I think they really took off around 1916, 1917. Then, of course, the war caused a problem with that. But you start to see the automobile becoming a means to move away from the central city. This is when houses are going up in Washington Heights. The Washington Highlands takes off in 1919. And people are able to travel away from that congestion. Surely by 1919, to a degree 1916, 1917. Prior to that, I left out a part about Chauffeur's Alley on East Windsor Place. A lot of the houses went up with no garages. There were a few garages built in basements that had ramps where you put the car underneath the dining room because there was no space on that lot. But you can look at ads for the 1916 auto show. And what you'll find is that Ford plant was backordered. They were backordered several thousand cars, and they didn't even have a booth at the auto show. People didn't know how to drive them. They didn't have a place to put them. Anybody else?
Well, I want to ask a question about the tavern, because you know we always thought, because it had ship-to-shore radio,
yes,
that I gave to the Pabst Mansion, that there was actually some bootlegging going on. But I wonder, have you ever come across anything that there was any bootlegging
yes.
along?
Yeah, there was. And there's a reason there was. You'll know this. I grew up in the Detroit area, and we would often go down in the summertime on the Detroit River, look at the grain elevators of Seagulls. And there was a saying that during Prohibition, everybody in Detroit was a member of the Yacht
Club.
And you could go to Canada, and Canada had Prohibition, but there were no restrictions against exporting Seagram's whiskey. So if you had a boat, and you could get from here to Windsor, Canada, you could load the boat with Seagram's whiskey and bring it back
bring it
to the
here.
Town.
Wow. That's great. Thank you.
We are going to wrap up, but if anyone has, you know, Brian will be around for a few minutes if you want to just. So thank you so much.